Three verses.
One.
This is your life.
Two.
This is your digital life.
Three.
This is Spark. cbc.ca/spark.
Hi, I'm Nora Young, and on Spark this time, love, sex, and relationships. We look at how sex fuels technological change, explore how people are doing international trade one personal relationship at a time, but first, a love story. Kisses from Spark. Meet Steph.
Okay. Steph Bianco.
And Steph's husband, Lou, Luigi.
Luigi Bianco.
Steph loves Lou, and Lou loves Steph.
What do I love about you? Everything.
You think I'm smart.
You are brilliant. You are brilliant.
Steph and Lou agree about most things. They don't have any major disagreements. But the one thing this couple does disagree about is what to do with the dirty dishes. Steph likes to let them soak.
So that when I do actually do the dishes, it's easier to scrub off and I don't have to use as much water.
Lou, on the other hand, is decidedly anti-soak.
I don't like things to be sitting in the sink, to be brutally honest. particularly water, standing water. We have a cat. The cat's got meat in the dish, soaking in there. It just looks like a swamp.
Now, this is an issue that sat unresolved like a pile of unwashed dishes for years. But today, on our radio program, we're going to try and settle the debate once and for all. And we're going to need some help from this guy.
My name's Justin Marinos. I'm a web designer.
Yeah, a web designer. Justin is the creator of a website called Sidetaker.com, and it's designed to help couples, roommates, and coworkers decide who is more wrong, as they say. Here's how it works.
One person that wants to start an argument will add their side of the story, and then they'll send an email invite to the other side. And once the second side is added, the community will be able to decide who's right and wrong based on the information they give.
Okay, so here's what we're up to. We want you to test drive this website for us. It's called Sidetaker. And you guys have graciously agreed to try out the site for us, and we'll see what kind of responses we get back, okay?
Free counseling. Yeah. Sounds good to me.
Service to society.
Now, I first talked to Lou and Steph a few weeks ago. Since then, they each typed up their own side of the dish-soaking argument and posted it to Sidetaker.com. So people have been voting for who they think is right for weeks now. And meanwhile, Lou and Steph promise not to peek. So at the end of this episode, Lou and Steph will be back to find out who won. So stay tuned. Now, when you think of the big game changers in the technology world, who do you think of?
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs.
CEO Steve Jobs. Mr. Jobs, it's a great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you.
No, keep trying.
Google.
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 That's right. Google.
Nope, there's an even bigger force pushing technology into new directions.
Pornography.
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 Look into his eyes. They're the eyes of a man obsessed by sex.
Okay, maybe you look at porn and maybe you don't. I'm not here to judge. But whether you do or not, the story of pornography's growth as an industry is inextricably linked with the progress of technology.
You may not look at pornography, but you have definitely felt its effects. It's one of the most powerful drivers of digital technology there is.
That's Peter Nowak. He's CBC.ca's senior technology writer, and he's writing a book on this very subject called Bombs, Boobs, and Burgers, How the Technologies of War, Sex, and Food Transformed Our World. So we're going to talk about the business of pornography and what it has to show us about technology and business innovation. It's not graphic, but it does acknowledge the existence of pornography and sex, so judge accordingly. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Nora.
So after all your research, how much do you know about pornography?
I know far too much, more than I want to.
So the book you're writing is about the relationship between the development of technology and these powerful industries, including porn. What intrigued you about the relationship between pornography and technology?
Well, I think it's the idea that it's such a frowned upon industry by many people, yet it's responsible for so many things around us that we don't even know about, you know, whether it's consumer electronics or internet stuff. It's really a key driver of technology.
Like what?
Well, in the early days or in the middle of the 20th century, it wasn't necessarily pornography that drove these things, but it was sexual uses of stuff like Polaroid cameras, for example. You know, you could get arrested if you went to the Photoshop and got your naked photos of your wife if you tried to develop them. Mm-hmm. So, of course, one of the first uses for the Polaroid was to take, you know, to get away with that sort of thing.
Right.
And Polaroid, you know, kind of tacitly took advantage of this. They released a camera in the late 60s called the Swinger.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always heard that story about the porn industry kind of helping the VHS format trounce the beta. Is that a technology urban myth or is that true?
No, that's actually pornography's almost poster child for technology speaking. The VCR, when it first came out, Hollywood hated it. Oh, they thought, oh, this is going to lead to piracy. And there was, you know, so they actually sued Sony. And while this lawsuit was going on, the porn companies were saying, hey, this is great.
Mm.
So they started pumping stuff out. On the flip side of that, too, there was also the format war, right, between VHS and Betamax. And Sony didn't allow the porn companies to use Betamax, so they went to VHS.
Hmm.
So the war is settled by this big market choosing VHS.
Right. Yeah, I want to talk a bit about how the porn industry is dealing with the illegal downloading of movies and why it's having more success at stopping this than sort of mainstream Hollywood is with regular movies. It's pretty easy to download regular movies online. How about downloading pornographic movies?
It's a lot harder. It is. I mean, it's out there. You can find porn movies on BitTorrent sites. But it is a lot more difficult because they have a lot more at stake here. Hollywood, when they release a movie, you know, they make zillions from box office. Porn companies don't have that same luxury. They rely entirely on DVD sales or on online sales, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they've got it. They're far more vigilant in this sort of thing. They're far more persistent. So they are right on, whether it's Pirate Bay or whoever, they're right on these torrent sites. And they're also on, there's a lot of YouTube clones too as well.
So if pornography is often driving innovation in the technology sphere, what new things is the porn industry introducing to try and get at this issue of illegal downloads?
Well, one of the things they're trying to do is something called teledildonics, which is, this is sort of a technology under development for some years now, but they're really starting to take strides with it. One of the things that the Adult Entertainment Broadcast Network has come out with is called the Real Touch. And what it is it's, without getting graphic, it's basically a sex simulator. It's about the size of a toaster, I guess you could say, and it's for a man, and a man puts it on his, you know.
Body, yes.
Yeah, and the inside of it is, it's got haptic technology, the sort of thing that you see in your Xbox controllers or even your cell phone when it's set on vibrate. And the inside of it actually warms. And so anyway, so this thing is linked to your computer to specially coded movies. So essentially what's happening is that what you're seeing on screen is synced to the machine and the machine replicates the action on screen.
And so the idea being that if you had a pirated copy of the movie, this thing wouldn't work with it?
Exactly.
Right, okay. Is mainstream Hollywood going to learn any lessons from this?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's almost history repeating itself. Back in the 50s when television was coming in, Hollywood also felt threatened. They thought, oh, we're going to lose all these viewers. So they started experimenting with stuff like 3D and widescreen. So interestingly, now in this age of piracy that we have, you see this summer, we've got, you know, a whole slew of 3D movies coming out.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, actually. I mean, 3D is just in the news so much now, right? Like that movie Up is at Cannes. And actually, a couple of weeks ago, the CEO of Canada's Cineplex movie chain was quoted as saying, I think 3D is here to stay, and it's basically what I would call a major game changer for our business going forward. Now, he wasn't addressing downloading and combating download in particular, but it's interesting giving in the context of what you're saying. So, Pete, let's get back to porn, shall we?
Sure.
Is the pornography industry changing its online business model in other ways? What are some of the other things they're doing?
Yeah, in a couple of ways, actually. One of the things that's happening is with the same creators of the Real Touch, AEBN, they pioneered this a few years ago at something called pay-per-use. So rather than charging you a monthly subscription to, you know, basically watch all the porn you want, they charge you by the minute. And they've become one of the most profitable porn companies on the internet because of this. And this is starting to filter into the mainstream. You know, the New York Times just announced that they're looking at a model where they may start charging readers by the story, right? It's an interesting model. One of the models that the porn industry definitely pioneered that's now used widely by the mainstream is the idea of affiliate marketing. It's in everything you see on the internet. If you go to a website and you see, you know, a little window where you can search for a book on Amazon or for eBay, or even if you're, you know, you might be on somebody's blog and they might have a little Google window there, right? Mm-hmm. All of these things can be sourced back to the porn industry because the porn industry developed this affiliate program where two websites will team up. So if you're visiting one website and you see a little link to another website and you actually follow it, that website will then give a kickback to the other website. This is actually the whole fundamental business model of Google.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. Thanks, Pete.
Thank you.
Peter Nowak is CBC.ca's technology reporter, and he's also writing a book called Bombs, Boobs, and Burgers, How the Technologies of War, Sex, and Food Transformed Our World. It'll be out in spring 2010, but in the meantime, you can read Pete's book blog, where he posts lots of interesting stories about technology, and you can find a link at our website, cbc.ca/spark.
Let the carnage begin.
I'm Nora Young, and you're listening to Spark on CBC Radio 1. Today, we're talking a little bit about relationships. And of course, we usually think about relationships as relationships with people, you know, our friends and loved ones. But we also have a relationship with food and with all the people who had a hand in getting it to our tables. Like, take a melon. A farmer grew it in Honduras, where a worker picked it. Someone else loaded it onto a container ship and sent it to Florida. Dock worker loaded it onto a flatbed and a trucker drove it over a 1,000-kilometer distance to the fruit stand where I bought it from a seller. Now, I know that because we looked into where melons come from, but most of us aren't able to talk to the shipper and trace the route of our food from the field to the table. All those human relationships that connect us to our food are invisible, especially if it's coming from far away. And this bothers Kate Rich, an artist and trader living in Bristol, England. If she's pulling couscous off the shelves at the grocery store, she wants more than nutritional information on the label.
You find them on the supermarket shelf and they're kind of stripped of all association. You know, it might seem like made in China, or in the couscous case, made in Morocco. Mm-hmm. Where in Morocco and who made it? And then how did it get here? You know, like what hands carried it and what processes did it go through?
Okay, so why doesn't Kate just buy fair trade products? Well, they often give you those kinds of details, the human story behind the food. But the thing is, Kate doesn't really agree with fair trade either, because the way it's marketed in the UK, at least, is kind of patronising.
With fair trade coffee, you tend to get the bag with a picture of the farmer smiling and holding up his product, and his name and a little statement that generally says that he uses the money for his children's education. And I found that disturbing at a number of levels. I felt that it really potentially patronised both the farmer and myself by assuming that I was making a moral judgment on what he would do with the money. Mm. And also that he had no ability through that system to make a moral judgment on where I got my money from,
right.
And whether he found me suitable to sell to.
So Kate designed her own trade system, and she called it feral trade. Here's how it works. You know when you're going on a trip and a friend asks you to bring something back, such as cigars from Cuba or chocolates from Belgium? Well, Kate took that one step further and set up a network of travelers who carry goods around the world in their luggage and deliver it to someone at the other end of the line. She's even got some coffee in transit right now between Banff and Toronto. Goods are being passed by hand in airports, train stations, and tube stops all over the world.
Today, for example, just before I got to the studio, I received a shipment of couscous from Morocco, and that was a friend of a friend of a colleague of a sister's friend. So it was really quite a long chain of association. She'd heard about the project and emailed me and asked me if I wanted some couscous from Morocco, and I said sure. And she said that she was changing planes in London today and I happened to be free. So I came up from Bristol, met her at the London Luton Airport.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm recording this for Canadian radio, I hope you don't mind.
Okay.
And she arrived with her rolling luggage and I arrived with my empty rolling luggage. And I said, you know, can we do the exchange here on the airport concourse to, you know, make a great photo op, basically.
Do you mind if I take a photo?
Sure.
Of you freshly arrived?
And she was sort of, is this legit? We've just met and we're unpacking our bags and swapping stuff over. And we was like, well, why not, you know?
Yeah, it is legit. And Kate declares the goods at the border. And the product's every move is meticulously documented on her website. For Kate, feral trade is about knowing the provenance of your food, but also about building a social relationship with the producer, like the experience you have when you visit a farmer's market and meet the man or woman behind the blueberries.
Another thing I was interested in doing was to test the kind of load-bearing capacity of social networks. So how, you know, if you could send something more material along those routes than JPEGs. On Facebook, you know, you have 300, 1,000 friends. When you're actually trying to send freight around, it's a really good way of testing how real those social connections are. You know, can someone actually meet you at this time of place? And are they prepared to carry 5 kilos of something in their hand baggage?
On the site, visitors can track waybills, routes. They can see photos and read anecdotes. Why do you put this information online?
Partly to replace this, or restore this kind of lost biography of the product, that the receiver can see the way it's travelled and see the network of connections that's brought it there. Also to try and bring some kind of reciprocity to this so that the producer can see as much about the consumer as vice versa.
Right.
So really replacing, you know, providing something that's not available with fair trade.
You know, there's a lot of talk right now about sort of our ability to track the provenance of the goods that we buy, you know, whether it's food or whatever. Why do you think there's such an appetite for this information?
Good question. You know, there's this book, The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, which starts with its premise, there's too much choice. You know, there's too much choice in the food landscape, and it's something that disturbs people. So there's a kind of quest for authenticity, purity, are ways for people to kind of get some kind of grasp or control over their diet. I find a lot of the provenance information in food either misleading or partial. The fact that there's never any negative information contained in food packaging, and there's a lot of negative information in my, you know, that I have like tea from Bangladesh is from this very troubled situation. It's on land that is seized from its original owners, who are now the employees of the tea plantation. So but the tea's delicious, you know, and the land it is from is very verdant and beautiful. There's a lot of troubled stories about the product itself that I try to faithfully deliver with the goods, and I think that adds to their interest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So feral trade is an experiment. Obviously, we're not all going to get our international goods this way. It wouldn't scale. But it does point to a couple of key trends. First, the trend in tracking where your food comes from. But also a second related trend is the ability to use the mapping power of the web to document and share this kind of information, even down to the micro personal level. We've got another story on getting close to your food. It's called spin farming, taking small urban plots of land and planting dense crops there. It'll air on an upcoming episode of Spark, but you can listen to it now on demand at our website, cbc.ca/spark. I'd love to know what gardeners and farmers alike think.
Hello, everybody. We are going to do a show today. Yay! It is
on the air.
It is
online.
It is
from the Canadian
Broadcasting Corporation.
It is called
Spark.
Spark. Spark.
Tech, trends, and fresh ideas.
cbc.ca/spark.
You're listening to Spark on CBC Radio 1. I'm Nora Young, and I love to travel like a lot of people. It's that excitement of immersing yourself in a different culture. And so does technology journalist Sarus Farivar. So why is it that in an age when it's easier to travel than in previous generations, it's harder and harder to get under the skin of another culture? Here's Sarus.
I just got back from spending 7 months living in Lyon, France. As much as I loved living abroad, there's no better feeling than coming home again. I get to see family and friends and experience the California sunshine that I love once again. But here's one thing that I realized, maybe around halfway through my time over there. I'd become culturally lazy. So now that I'm back, culturally speaking, it's almost as if I've never left. While I was over there, I could consume all the same media as I would here. The internet has now reached a point where I can download any American or Canadian radio show I want via podcast, or snag any TV show online. I can read any newspaper or magazine on the web. I can call my friends and family back home for free on Skype. But it wasn't always like this. Even though I was born and raised in California, I've lived abroad 3 times in the last 12 years. 1997 was the first time. That was in Switzerland. You know, Alps, Lake Geneva, the whole bit. I could read up on what was going on at home, but this was well before blogs, Facebook, and all the rest. Believe it or not, the best way for me to communicate with folks back home, besides an email blast, was good old-fashioned letters and maybe the occasional phone call. Fast forward to 2002, when I was abroad in Senegal. Among the group of Americans and Canadians that I studied with, we had regular internet access, and we shared a single cell phone. I often read the American newspapers online every day, and I could send email home. But again, for the most part, my friends and I emailed and left comments on each other's live journals. Now, that's all changed. Recently, I realized that I could still be in the U.S., even though I was away. Here's what I mean. Now, with blogs, Twitter, Facebook, Skype, BitTorrent, and podcasts, my headspace was in the U.S. and Canada.
This is a CBC podcast.
Sure, I may have been living in France, but my mind was in North America. People back home used to ask me how the economic crisis was affecting France, but honestly, I had no idea. I mean, the cafes that I went to in France seemed to be doing okay. But when I was at that cafe, I was reading the New York Times on my iPhone, not Le Monde, because I didn't have to.
Oui, on a choisi. On va prendre deux cafés et puis une tarte aux fraises, s'il vous plaît.
Now, I should say that I speak fluent French, so I could have read French newspapers or listened to French podcasts, or heck, read French blogs if I'd wanted to. But the thing is, I didn't have to. I could and I did exist, both mentally and culturally, almost exclusively in North America.
My fellow citizens.
Heck, I listened to the Obama inauguration speech over an American public radio internet stream on my iPhone while on a bus going back to my apartment in Lyon. In other words, I discovered that it's become incredibly easy to be an American, or whatever nationality really, while abroad. The whole reason why anyone goes abroad in the first place is to experience another culture. And what I've come to realize is that making that mental shift is now getting harder and harder, as I can mentally exist wherever I want. I mean, there was this whole French cultural world that was right outside my door. But we're human, and humans are lazy. And that's what I'm saying, is that I've been culturally lazy, simply because I could be. Should I be worried or even ashamed of my behavior? Maybe. I think it's just easier to be lazy. Plus, the North American public radio is just that much better, right? For Spark, I'm Cyrus Farivar, Oakland, California.
If you'd like to follow Cyrus's writings, we've got a link to his blog at our blog, cbc.ca/spark. Okay, it's time for the big reveal, as they say. Now, earlier we talked about this website called Sidetaker.com, where couples or roommates or friends each post their side of a disagreement online at the site, and complete strangers cast a vote for who they think is right. Now, we asked Lou and Steph Bianco to test drive the site for us. Steph likes to soak the dishes before washing, and Lou doesn't. So let's call Lou.
Hello.
Hello, Lou.
That's me.
Hi, it's Nora.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks. So, you ready to hear the results?
Yeah.
Well, the internet's voted and you won. What do you say?
Yeah. I knew I was going to win. Come on. What was the numbers?
Well, okay, we had 229 people who voted overall.
Yeah.
And 80% voted for you, Lou, and 20% for Steph.
It's because they wrote such a convincing argument, I think.
Now, what do you think Steph is going to say?
Oh, she's going to be crushed.
Oh. I think you better get the laughing over with now.
Yeah.
Might
yeah.
not go over so well. So let's phone her up, shall we?
Okay.
All right.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Steph?
Hi.
Hi. So, Steph, Luigi has something to tell you. I've got him on the line. Luigi?
Steph, it was really close.
Uh-huh.
But they tallied. They had over 200 people, and they said that you probably shouldn't just let the dishes soak. You should probably wash them as soon as possible.
Do I believe you?
I'm sad to say, Steph, Lou is telling you the truth. Yeah, he won. The internet supported his position. What do you say, Steph?
What do I say? It's biased because he's a writer.
Oh.
Oh, because of my argument?
I think so. I think you pulled on some heartstrings or something.
Now, I have to say, a lot of people commented on your story as well as voting.
Okay.
Lux wrote in to say that Lou should appreciate the fact that she tries, and Steph should appreciate the fact that he's volunteering to do the dishes and let him back away from the sink. Another comment says, the person who does the dishes gets to decide how they are done.
Oh, perfect. So we get to say Lou is doing the dishes. Excellent. Okay. All you, buddy. All you.
Hold up.
So what happens now? Is it back to business as usual?
I think if Lou wants to take on the role, I'm happy to give it up.
Wait a minute.
Maybe this didn't work out quite right after all. Thanks, you guys. You've both been fantastic sports.
Oh, thank you.
Yay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
That's it for Spark this time around. Spark was made this week by Dan Meisner, Elizabeth Bowie, intern Allison Buchan-Terrell, and me, Nora Young, and by
Steph Bianco,
Luigi Bianco,
Justin Marinos,
Peter Nowak,
Kate Rich,
and Saruz Farivar.
Spark was made with Creative Commons music and effects. Find the artists and titles at the blog. That's also where you can find this show and every episode we've ever made for your delectation. You can also get sneak previews and special online-only content. I'll be there, and I hope to see you there, too. I'd love to know what you think of what's on the show. Send me an email, spark@cbc.ca, or give us a ring, 1-877-34-SPARK, or you can follow us on Twitter. Just search for Spark CBC. I'm Nora Young, looking for love in all the wrong places. Talk to you next time. We'll be right back.